On this episode of Skeptico, Alex talks with noted Australian UFO researcher, Mary Rodwell.
Because we're still in a paradigm that is so limited in terms of how we accept extraordinary human experience. And this is the dilemma, because in psychology, psychiatry, everything is seen as some kind of dysfunction primarily. You know, as soon as you experience non-ordinary states of any kind, the traditional conventional way of looking at that as something that says this is an aberration, rather than saying, hold on a minute here, we've got people from all belief systems, all professions, all ages commenting on these experiences. Can we not start to look at this scientifically now with an open mind, so we can at least look at the patterns, even if we don't understand yet how our science can quantify it? Why can't we find a way of at least looking at the patterns of this so that we can get some sense of what this is saying to us about reality itself and consciousness?
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, I kind of put a capstone on this series of interviews I've been doing on alien encounters and how that relates to extended human consciousness, if you will. Now, since this is the third in a series of interviews I've done between researcher Mary Rodwell and Dr. David Jacobs, you might want to go back and listen to those other two interviews before you listen to this one. But if you're one of those people that don't mind jumping right into the middle of a conversation, you can start right here as well. And I actually think you'll probably catch on pretty good to what we're talking about. Now, this interview breaks from the usual format I follow. It's more of a conversation. I even left in some of the beginning talk that I usually edit out. But since we just did kind of roll into this conversation, I really didn't know when to begin it. And I felt like there was some good stuff at the beginning, so I left that in as well. As I think you can tell from this interview, I have a lot of respect and admiration for Mary Rodwell. I think she's one of the clearest, most articulate voices in this field. I think she has so much to say, not just about encounters with aliens, as strange as that sounds, but I think she brings into focus so many of these questions we've been having about extended human consciousness, near-death experience, out-of-body experience, psychedelic experiences, and how those all might relate to better understanding who we are, what this consciousness thing is all about. It does strike me as a little bit funny that I talk to so many highly credentialed, highly respected academics in neuroscience and neuropsychology, and so few of them stack up anywhere close to being as articulate, well-versed, and have such a broad understanding of these larger questions, as does our guest, Mary Rodwell. So with that, let's get right to the conversation.
How's everything with you? I guess you've had guests and stuff.
Yes, family, and it was lovely catching up with all of them and whatever. And you're sort of always, I don't know if you feel the same, but I feel whenever I get tied up with family things, all I'm thinking about, on the other hand, is I haven't answered the 30 emails I've got today. Tomorrow I'll have 60. And, you know, so that in the back of your mind is, how long is it going to take you to get through, you know, from the time that, unless you're on it every day, you know how it builds up. It's just like that's always in the background. So, yeah, so it's all good.
I imagine it'd be even harder for you because connection that you form with people is in a lot of ways deeper. You know, I mean, there's people out there that are obviously in a lot of need and a lot of pain and are looking for you. I mean, that's, I guess with your nursing background, you can kind of be more used to that. I think that'd be hard for me to, when the emails are piling up, knowing that there's people that are really, you know, so dependent on you. Doesn't that ever kind of work on you a little bit?
It does when I'm away primarily, because I can't always get to my emails as quickly. And people are so grateful that you've even bothered to answer their email a lot of the time, because they say, look, we've tried to talk to other researchers, and often they don't even answer our emails, so they feel very abandoned. So I'm sort of very aware that it matters that I don't leave it too long, you know, that I answer people, because of that, you know, this may be the first time they've ever had a response. And that's very, very important. The acknowledgement that, look, you know, there's something going on, and yes, I understand, you know, and how can I help and whatever. A lot of the work in recent times, Alex, is about connecting people to each other or to resources elsewhere. And I'm, you know, continually looking for good resources in each country. I get so many from the US, you would not, more than I get from Australia now, believe it or not, which is to me quite incredible, given there's so much more in terms of resources in the US, that why are they, you know, in touch with me in Australia, when really I don't know why that is. And I'm not sure whether it's because my material for some people resonates more, and they feel that that is where they need to go, rather. And I think perhaps it's that. That's the only difference I can see, because there are lots of resources in the US now, isn't there, in terms of all of this?
Well, you know, there are on one hand, and on the other hand, it's a confusing kind of landscape to traverse. And I think that you come through with a very clear message. And I think you have a lot of credibility. Just, I think your presence, you know, it really is, we can talk these woo-woo terms, but you have a certain presence that is very comforting, but you also have a clarity, like, you know, not like overconfident clarity, but just like, hey, you know, this is the way that it is, that I think really helps. Because a lot of people in this field, when they speak, you're kind of going, now where is that really coming from, you know, and what's kind of next, you know, what card are they playing from, what camp are they in, kind of thing. And I think that, you know, what we're talking about here kind of relates to the David Jacobs thing, because I think the shadow of David Jacobs, Bud Hopkins, still looms, and it probably looms larger in the United States than it does in other parts of the world. And one of the things I was hoping that we could come out of this with is, if there's any ways that you think this thing is going, that if I can help in any way, I mean, with these interviews, I want to get those out there. But also, I almost feel like if there's a way that we can move this thing in a direction, and if I can help in that in any way, and I don't know what that means at this point, but I'd like to do that, because I see this as an area that not only ties into my interests in terms of, you know, near-death experience and spiritually transformative experiences, because you see the same thing there, right? People, less so with near-death experience, but with these spiritually transformative experiences, people are looking for help and they're looking for answers. And you're a people helper. I'm more of an information conduit kind of thing, but there's a lot of work to be done. maybe we can find something.
I think that you've hit the nail on the head. Something I didn't ever expect, Alex, in terms of my work, was how much of I would have to do in the public forum. Primarily, I'm a therapist. You know, I'm a counselor, et cetera, et cetera. I help people deal with various issues to get new perspectives for their own healing and integration, et cetera. I never realized that information, the dearth of information in terms of extraordinary human experience, is the problem, because we're still in a paradigm that is so limited in terms of how we accept extraordinary human experience. And this is the dilemma, because in psychology, psychiatry, everything is seen as some kind of dysfunction primarily. You know, as soon as you experience non-ordinary states of any kind, then you've got still the traditional conventional way of looking at that as something that says this is an aberration, rather than saying, hold on a minute here. We've got people from all belief systems, all professions, all ages commenting on these experiences. can we not start to look at this, you know, scientifically now with an open mind so we can at least look at the patterns, even if we don't understand yet how quantum, how our science can quantify it? Why can't we find a way of at least looking at the patterns of this so that we can get some sense of what this is saying to us about reality itself and consciousness?
I mean, that's such a common sense approach. But again, I mean, that to me is like the clarity that you bring. I mean, that's very common sense. It's very straightforward and it makes perfect sense. And I think that we need more and more people who just kind of lay that out in that way. I do have to tell you, you know, I just published last week on Skeptico, I published an interview that I did with a Montreal-based hypnotherapist that does between life and past life regressions. And it's a very controversial area, obviously, but the guy's extremely well qualified, not at all woo-woo. He's hooked up with the University of Montreal. Do you know Mario Beauregard, Dr. Mario Beauregard? Have you ever heard of him?
It rings a bell, actually.
He wrote a book called The Spiritual Brain. He's a highly respected psychologist, neuropsychologist, but he's at the University of Montreal. What I was really going to say is, in my interview with Jean-Charles Chabot, who is the between life guy, I said, look, you know, let's forget about the between life and the past life regression. Let's just look at hypnosis. And you have to understand that mainstream science rejects the whole idea of hypnosis. They reject it because they reject the idea that there is such a thing as consciousness that is other than the brain. And since hypnosis suggests, when there's, you can go to Google Scholar and look up scholarly papers that are done on people who are in hypnosis and are asked to, given the suggestion to make bones grow. You know, these are people with broken bones. And they do it, which completely contradicts this model that we have of this strict mind equals brain. I always feel the need to bring people back and say, hey, you know, it's not just the skeptics. Forget about the skeptics. It's science. Science doesn't accept this. So we can get people, like you were saying with the analytics, we can get these people together and we can say, okay, look, but the guy grew the bone in his arm. So he clearly was in an altered state of consciousness, and you don't accept consciousness. You don't accept that consciousness can do anything. Can we at least move past that? And there's a real resistance to it because they see the slippery slope and they see you coming. And right now they can kind of push Mary and that crowd off and say, oh, don't even listen to that. But as soon as that door opens a little bit and they say, wait a minute, there is a consciousness. Now we have to start taking seriously altered consciousness. Now we have to start taking in seriously extraordinary alternative. You know, now it's like, oh, crap, you know, we really have to deal with that. So let me tell you a little bit, because you're so generous with your time here, you don't need to hear me rattle on. Here's where I came down with Jacobs, had a long conversation with Jacobs. In some ways, not a lot, you know, surprising, but I talked directly about you, and I told him that I interviewed you. I kind of broke it down like the John Mack camp and the Bud Hopkins, David Jacobs camp, and he just held to the line, you know. As a matter of fact, he was even more strident than I've heard him before, you know, and he said, all that John Mack stuff, all that spiritual stuff, it just, none of it works, none of it stands up to scrutiny, none of it stands up to careful analysis. And then where I really pushed him, it's something that you and I touched on, and it really tickled me to kind of push him on this, because I said, you know, Dr. Jacobs, do you think there's such a thing as a genuine spiritual experience? Is there such a thing? I said, because it seems to me that you guys are humanists, you know, that Bud Hopkins was a humanist and you kind of come from the humanist side of things in your work as a historian. It's a code word for atheism, you know, and it's just saying, hey, there's no, it comes back to what we're talking about. In this mainstream science, there is no such thing as consciousness. There's really no such thing as really any kind of real experience per se. It's all just kind of this random stuff. Is there a spiritual experience? And he danced around, but he basically said, no, I don't believe there's such a thing as a genuine spiritual experience. I think in a way, it kind of then all falls from there. I mean, it's exactly what you and I suspected. If you reject that people even have spiritual experiences, that's a lens that then does it. here's what I did get out of it that I wanted to bounce off of you. And I actually have an interview scheduled with someone, forensic hypnosis thing. Is he said, hey, look, the methodology has to be different. And the methodology has to be along the lines of forensic hypnosis. And there's actually quite a bit of research. I'm sure you're much more well-versed in it than I am on forensic hypnosis. I've hooked up with someone at University of Liverpool where they've done some really fantastic research for getting into the court system and, you know, how to really use witnesses who are highly suggestible versus not, and all this, and the best procedures and stuff like that. The problem with all that, as I see it, though, is if we try and pack things into, on one hand, the forensic approach is great because it says, okay, what really happened? But as you and I know from a spiritual experience kind of thing, that doesn't exactly fit. If you take near-death experience, okay, that's how I break down near-death experience. You know, you go talk to the doctors and they go, okay, clearly we have all these people that didn't have a brain. You know, it was cardiac arrest, more than 15 seconds, there's no brain. But now we have all these allegorical, metaphorical, you know, contradictory, the language of that other realm isn't forensic detail yet. I think that there's a certain reality to, we have to kind of try and sift through it in that way. So that's what's really the crux of I wanted to talk to you about and see what your thoughts are of, you know, you can see the appeal for the forensic, let's do it in a very, you know, systematic way to make sure that we don't introduce this and that, because there's a reality to that that we have to acknowledge, that we can really kind of confuse the whole thing by suggesting things even when we're not trying to, or letting the other person on their own go and make stuff up, even if the therapist isn't doing it. So we have that side. And on the other side, we have the nature of this information might not lend itself to that kind of rigor. There, I'm going to shut up.
I understand why it's appealing to those that want to have a structure and a baseline to understanding hypnosis and experience. The problem with that is because they're not taking in consciousness itself, and the fact that we have the ability to travel out of body and have experiences alone. I mean, we talk about astral traveling alone and the experiences of those. Because they're not allowing for that, they're never going to get any further than where that road that they're treading. In other words, if you use forensic hypnosis for something like taking somebody back to an experience where they go up on the craft, what they will experience is purely what they're seeing. You know, oh, yes, I'm seeing three beings. I'm seeing there's a light there and I'm not seeing any corners and whatever. But if that person wants to get an understanding of that experience, they won't get it from that visual picture that they've got. They've got to tap into another part of them to get the greater understanding. Now, fascinating for me is when I say to people, when I take you into a hypnosis, I need you to honor the very first things that you see and experience. I don't want you thinking about them, because as soon as you think about them, you edit. You edit what's acceptable and not acceptable. So I need you to be pure in terms of your focus, so that when you see yourself, what exactly as you're seeing it, even if the being looks strange, weird and wonderful, and you really don't like what you're seeing and you'd like to change that, I said, that is where we have to stop it. So the whole idea is that we're looking for purity of the subconscious information. And what is hilarious is often what they expect and what they get are two different things. If they consciously wanted to have a picture of something, it will be quite different to what their subconscious offers them, and often challenges them in ways they never thought. And I say to them, you know, if this was a fantasy or an imagination, you wouldn't be picking that, because it's so different to anything you could possibly imagine. That in itself gives it credibility, because it's not what they would imagine. It's not what they would fantasize. In fact, it's often the last thing that they would want to fantasize or imagine. That gives it credibility. And this is my point, is that as long as they stick true to the first things that come in, which is uncluttered by their conscious mind, it's allowing a purity of the experience, however bizarre, weird, and wonderful, if you can honor that afterwards, you can pick it apart. You can say, okay, how does that resonate with you and whatever? And no matter how bizarre or weird, when I get to them at a certain point and say, does that resonate with you? Part of them reluctantly generally says, well, yes, actually it does, even though I'm still struggling with that information. Now that to me has an integrity. If you are going to only allow what is consciously acceptable, you are never going to get the purity of that experience. And that is my point with all of this, is that what I believe researchers, I think they've wanted to retain credibility. The nuts and bolts of a researcher are plainly trying to keep it as much as possible within a framework. When I'm saying actually that framework isn't useful because it limits what the person can actually explore. And if we are truly wanting to explore multidimensional reality, we have to let go of our own paradigm, and they have to let go of theirs if they want to really see what they are experiencing in its multidimensional nature. We may not understand it scientifically yet, but that doesn't take away from its credibility and its integrity. And when you get patterns that are coming up time and time again with different people of different ages, different beliefs, different professions, all coming up with similar patterns, then that has to have some form of veracity, because otherwise every regression would be different. Every pattern would be different. And it's not. Many of the patterns are actually identical. And, you know, when I work in hypnosis, I will deliberately try and see if I can alter their response just to make sure that they are being honest with what they're seeing. And I'll say to them, and they'll say, oh, I'm seeing three beings. And I'll say, oh, so what color is their hair? And they will disqualify that and say, there's no hair. I can't make them see hair. I can say to them, what's in the corner of the room? And if they're on a craft, the first thing they're going to say is there's no corners. So even if I try and input information, which I do deliberately, they will disqualify it. If I try to say a certain thing to them, they will disqualify it. And this happens time and time and time again. And yet afterwards, they are even struggling with it. But if people say to me, what is the evidence of that experience? Because they haven't got bits of the craft, they haven't X, Y, and Z. I said, the evidence is in the whole fact that they change as individuals. You don't change after hallucinations. You don't change after fantasies, but you do change after an experience. And every single person after these experiences changes in a multitude of ways, from in terms of their understanding of their own spirituality, consciousness, even in terms of their motivations and their focus. That is evidence of a reality, even if you can't make it any more tangible at this present time. But the patterns, the constant patterns that I get time and time again with people that may have read nothing on this experience, literally nothing, and that they will still, and there's some unique things that they will say that only those that have an encounter will say. But if you're still going down the role of trying to keep this into a paradigm that is limited, which we know the third dimensional world is a very limited paradigm. None of us fit in that box, really, truthfully, you know, no matter how hard we might like to. I remember talking to a group of businessmen. I think it was either Probus or Rotary. And I remember a gentleman coming up to me and saying, oh, you're the UFO lady. I'm going to have fun with you. So I started off with something I don't normally do. And as all these sort of 60, 17-year-old businessmen, you know what I mean, very, very much of their generation, I said, I would like to challenge you in this room that every one of you has had an experience that you can't explain in third dimensional terms. Not one hand went up. And the guy that was going to challenge me didn't say a word. Because the truth is, we're all multidimensional. Even if we're not aware or honor it, it's there. And the bottom line is for me is that we, on some level, if you resonate to that material, no matter how bizarre, weird and wonderful it might be, all it's saying is you're not consciously aware of that other part of you yet. But often through meditation and many other things, we discover that there is another aspect. For example, I mean, I've done past life work and I've had some really interesting results to that. Some very tangible. One lady came to me. She was terrified of birds. Never knew why. Absolutely phobic of birds. And what bothered her was her husband wanted to go to Ireland and he wanted to visit a falconry. And she said, I can't go anywhere near it, Mary, because, and I don't know where it comes from. I've got nothing that's happened in my life, etc. So I said, well, I'll tell you what, we're going to talk to that part of you that knows. I call it the origin of that phobia. And it took her to medieval times where she was in, she was with her father, who was, believe it or not, a falconer, with brothers, and she was a girl, and she was being taught how to manage and learn how to manage her own falcon. But during that experience with her father, she did something wrong and she damaged his falcon. And she was devastated because he loved this bird. And she took the guilt on that through her own inexperience, she had damaged his falcon. And this was something that was, she felt like was an energetic imprint, if you like. And so we looked at how she could remove that energetically. We did that. She came out of the hypnosis saying, I would never in a million years have believed that, other than that's what I saw and experienced. The proof of the pudding with that, Alex, was 2 months later, she sends me a photograph with her, with a falcon standing, sitting on her arm, and said, look, Mary, it worked. Now, if you see that as symbolic, you see that as a creative fantasy that in some way worked, doesn't really matter, does it? Does it matter? The matter, you know?
Well, it doesn't, it doesn't, because it's challenging in a couple of ways. One, you, because you're obviously really bright, but you've approached this in a very methodical way, with the kind of controls that Jacobs is talking about too, right? So you're using some of the same techniques that a forensic therapist would use. But that is because you want to have some validation for yourself and for your clients that there's a reality to this that relates to our reality. You know what I mean? So that's what we're all doing. So I think to a certain extent, we're kind of torn, because sometimes the things that have most meaning don't fit our reality, and we just have to accept that. But sometimes they do. And so here's the part that challenges me. I look at, for example, the near-death experience and the spiritually transformative experiences. And I think I mentioned this to you before. You don't see the deception, the whole shamanic initiation thing. I mean, that works to a certain extent, but to another extent, it doesn't work and it doesn't happen and you don't see it in the near-death experience. If you do the between lives thing, one of the things that's interesting, this is a little bit of an aside, but I think it relates to what we're talking about. I was just watching Rick Martini. Have you seen his documentary on, he went to the Newton Institute and did this fabulous documentary,
yeah.
Flipside.
Yeah.
And he's actually a Los Angeles movie producer. He's done some pretty big movies. But one of the things that he pointed out that I really had to think about, the between lives information, science, if you want to call it that, contradicts a lot of Buddhist thought about what happens, right? So here we have this long tradition that everyone reveres, oh, the Buddhists and, you know, Tibetan Book of the Dead, and they know all about it. Now we have 7,000 people come back from Newton and say, no, that's not the way it is. The way you think about karma, it's not like that. There's no karmic penalty that you have to pay. It's total love, total forgiveness, total, you know, you're judging yourself. How can we make things better? That is also what comes through in the near-death experience, this kind of pureness of love in this. You don't get that from the abduction experience. You just don't. And not in that way. Isn't that a little unsettling? I mean, because if we add in the fact that there is this mind control aspect to it, if we add into the how humbling it is, right? Because we now realize that there's all these other dimensions and we realize where we sit in our narrow little focus here. Yeah. The opportunity for manipulation, the opportunity for some being which is of a higher order of consciousness, but isn't really of the highest order to kind of game the system in here. What are your thoughts on that?
You have to go to the soul itself and the origin of soul. And if we honestly feel, as my work has shown me, more than my background in Catholicism and all that rubbish that I was programmed into, was I learned more by reading and doing work with past lives, with in-between lives, with people going to the origin of their experiences of whatever it is. I learned more from that that I gave credibility to than I ever did through any belief system that I came across on this planet. Because that was going to the deeper part of someone's psyche. And I felt that had more credibility to me. Many of those that have had an experience like an abduction that's been traumatic or difficult, and they have felt very much victimized by various beings. I make sure that in all of that, we explore the experience, we explore their interaction with the beings, because there is always a dialogue that they're not consciously aware of. We also explore, and it's one of the questions I always ask, have you on any level, consented to this experience? They always go back to the soul and saying, before I came here, there was an agreement with particular species that I would experience, and there would be a trade-off between for the trauma, that would be a catalyst for X, for Y. And let's face it, we're very good at looking at good and bad. What we don't realize is that sometimes our most difficult, traumatic, painful experiences are the facilitator of the greatest growth and of understanding. And because it's painful, we see it as bad, instead of actually realizing that that's often the process of the greatest growth for us as we challenge ourselves through that process. And always it is the soul guiding the journey. That is how I see it. And that's what comes over time and time and time again.
That's awesome. It's just extremely, extremely challenging, because you also hear that from the between lives and the past life thing with murder. You even hear it with sexual abuse, which is just almost impossible for people to get their arms around. And I totally respect that. I can't even touch that. I just can't even touch that. I think it's really, really challenging to go there in a way that most people are going to be able to get close to or relate to. It's just too hard, because it calls into question some of our core beliefs about good, about bad.
Yes.
And fundamentally about who we are and how we control things. How firmly do you come down on that side of things? That because if I was going to take that all the way, I'd say that you're suggesting that these encounters with these alien abductions, that we have to understand them from that spiritual perspective, and that we cannot judge them without understanding that spiritual perspective. Is that to suggest that these beings are more spiritually advanced than we are? Would you go there?
I would say certainly some are.
Right. Well, some people are too. I mean,
yeah,
so
exactly.
are they just like us? Are they more? I mean, one of my working hypotheses is that they're a lot more like us than they're different from us. Even their technology, it seems way out there. But if we just take the 100 years and extrapolate a little bit, just a few hundred more, we might be able to get there. So maybe they're not technologically that far along, but maybe in this spiritual dimension, maybe they're not that far along. Maybe they're like us. Maybe some of them are perverts who are doing some pretty bad things, and other ones are loving beings. What are your thoughts on that?
I go back to if we talk about the monads, that we have soul groups and we interact with one another through different lifetimes. One of the very interesting things in my book was a lady who had implants, and she asked me if I could help her shift them or change them. I mean, she wasn't aware that they were physical so much as energetic. Now, this was very new to me at the time. What was fascinating was that she said she couldn't connect to her guides and her spiritual side because all she saw was beings and spaceships. And this frustrated her. And she couldn't even put her head in upright because of these implants. It was a really unusual regression in the sense that what I found, she isolated five places in her body which had implants, one in her head, one in her throat, one round her solar plexus, and one on her feet. So I said, okay, so who put them there? And she described three like reptilian beings as being responsible for them. And I said, so can we ask why that they put these in? She said, they put them in this lifetime. She said, because I had an agreement with them when I was in a concentration camp in Nazi Germany. I wanted to survive. So they said they'll help me survive if I agree that this lifetime, now this is really complex, I would have these implants and have the limits that went with these implants. One of them, the one in her head, which we removed, she explained what it did to consciousness. There was something that stopped her speaking about her experiences, which was another implant here. She went down her body. She knew exactly what each one represented. And we literally, energetically and spiritually removed them all, which was fascinating to see how she could articulate. She could create visually what they looked like, how she needed to remove them. So I found this fascinating that she'd seen it connected to a past life. We removed all of these as far as she was aware from her subconscious. She came out, she was able, they were gone. She felt she could straighten up her head. All those things were positive. But I went back to her about a year later and I said, do you still understand it in that way that you had agreed to these implants in a concentration camp in Nazi Germany? Actually, Mary, it came from Egypt when I was in Egypt before then, when I was aware of my future lives and I decided that I would have certain limits placed on me in this particular future lifetime. So actually, I was the orchestrator of my meeting with them and the agreement to have the implants in the present life that I have now. Now, wrap your head around that one.
No, you really can't. Because, okay, so let's immediately flip over since that's such a fantastic story. People do make this stuff up. We just know that they do. And we don't know what that means. Let me throw that in. We don't know that, like, if that's metaphorically true or has some kind of other meaning in some other way, you know, for this person. And I don't know. I'm not putting her down. I'm just saying, here's what the evidence tells me, that false memory, that's real. That's proven. There's too many good studies that show that people can have false memories. Now, again, you know, you have to open that up. What is a false memory? If it's a memory that doesn't conform to our consensus reality, and a group of kids say that they were sexually abused and they buried the bunnies and here are the bunnies and there's no bunnies there, you know, this. But then, so let's accept for a second that false memories happen. But the darndest thing is the people that want to go down that path are often these folks that then want to throw everything out and ignore the fact that, hey, recovered memories are true too. So, you know, in this real world here, we can have two sisters who are sexually abused in the worst way by a family member, and one of them says, no, it doesn't happen. And the other one says, bullshit, it happened. I was there and you were there and I know it happened because I saw it both. And the dad is in jail because it did find out that it was happening. We have physical evidence for it. So we know that that person really was able to repress memory. So now from this kind of this earth kind of reality thing, we got this total contradiction. We have this over here where this, there's a false memory because we know it's a false memory because it couldn't have happened. We have the same kind of eyewitnesses that says, no, you know, I was there with you. That didn't happen. And we have someone that says, I was there with you. It did happen. You know, so back to your story. Mm. What do we do with the fact that we can't necessarily trust all those stories? They may be meaningful for that person. They may propel them forward on their in their life's mission, but in the kind of sense that you and I are talking, it might not be real.
Firstly, you know, like I talked about the lady with the phobia of birds, at the end of the day, my work as a therapist is to enter someone's world and hopefully help them to understand more of their human experience. However they choose to interpret that is their choice.
Yes.
It's not my business.
Right.
What I do look at when I'm helping someone explore their experiences in terms of whether it's, you know, ET or anything else, I'm looking for patterns that I can work from. And that's the only thing I've got, because some people feel they've gone interdimensionally, for example. They see aspects of themselves not human. For example, they see planets that they say they've come from, where they describe how they live. All I can do with all of that is, okay, so that's, is there any others that have a similar kind of understanding when they go into that place? Do they, have they seen similar beings? Do they have the same understanding of them or how they operate or et cetera? And this is all I can do because I don't know what I don't know. And I can't say from a third dimensional perspective. I mean, it just doesn't even begin to touch the edges of this. So all I can do is continually look for those patterns, and that, and the fact that through those experiences, people change. However we want to look at it, they're transformative. They change the individual. So those is, that is the evidence. They don't change after hallucinations. And even with these experiences that people have on the craft, whether or not they can ever prove them, what are some ways that I work are, you know, when they come out with something extraordinary, I'm saying, look, you've articulated this in hypnosis. You can choose whether or not to believe what you've said or not. You can decide whether or not it resonates. And if it resonates, then you choose, okay, I'm going to integrate that or not. At the end of the day, that's up to you. All I can do, though, with that is say, okay, isn't that interesting? That's another aspect of this amazing, extraordinary, multidimensional experience. That's all I can ever do, because that's all I've got.
Fair enough. It's like you're sorting it and sifting it in different piles, you know, so you get it in these nice piles and that all works. You go, but wait a minute, I also have to sort it in this way. And then you get a total different organization. You're like, well, what the heck? I mean, whatever way I sort it, it comes out different.
We don't even know what we don't know. We don't even know what reality is. We don't even know how we may create our own experience through, look at the way that five people can see an accident and they'll all see different things.
Right. No, it's,
you know,
you're so right. Absolutely. We obviously don't have the right biological equipment to really deal with this. And even the biological equipment that we have enough knowledge of that to know its limitations, right? I mean, we see things differently. But I want to get back to the point, because you told that story and it was a great story. But back to that question then. So where are these beings on this scale that I want to impose on this, even if it's a false, phony scale of spiritual hierarchy?
Okay.
Where are they?
Okay, well, the way that I look at encounters now is that we have many types of physical forms, the extraterrestrial that has a physical form coming from wherever, many different maybe possible universes or whatever. Then we have the interdimensional ones, which are another aspect of encounters.
And those two might overlap in terms of being, that you're not necessarily excluding one from the other, right?
No. So not at all.
There could be a being from another universe that interacts physically and at other times interacts interdimensionally, like an OBE kind of thing.
Okay. Then we've got those that I don't know what else may parallel universes. We know there's possible visits from our future, because space-time is not how we understand it. So some could be from our future as well. They could be us from our future. One of the interesting things is with, in terms of time, space, and our own physical experience now, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that what we see as past lives are actually all happening right now. So we are, if you like, the soul is like the palm of the hand. Aspects of us are having different experiences in different realities at different times, in different dimensions, in different parallel universes. So have I done your head in enough? So it could be all of that.
Right.
For all we know.
Right. Right.
Angelic realms, are they a different frequency? Yes, very likely.
say that again, because that factors into the other one in a way that we have to kind of blur these lines and we don't really understand time and all that. But now we're going to step out there and say something like that, which I think has some basis to it and a lot of evidence that we come across, right? There are these angelic realms. There are these beings that we seem to encounter, these spirit guides that pop up, beings of light that pop up that seem to be on a different... How are you thinking that those, you're saying those are at a different level from what you can tell so far?
My understanding is that there are many levels of awareness as a soul, and some are more awake as a soul, as Newton talks about. Some have a higher awareness, a higher frequency, a broader understanding of their part in the matrix of what we understand as consciousness itself. And what I suspect happens is, in a human experience, looking at it from a spiritual perspective, we choose sometimes to be born in a limited way so we could experience the totality of that limit. I read a book called The Child of Eternity. She was born autistic. The interesting thing with the story was that the mother thought the child was very mentally backward in many ways, limited. She thought that she couldn't understand anything till the child was about 8 years old. The child was shown how to use a computer with assistance from the mother. All of a sudden, this child shows that despite the fact that it can't, that she couldn't articulate, that she couldn't relate in the normal human way, through computer, she showed exactly how intelligent she was and was downloading information through the computer, talking to a mother through the computer. Then out of the blue, this child said to her, "You need to connect to your spirit guide, Sebastian, because mum, he needs to connect with you." Now, this is not something she was taught. This was something that she understood from her own awareness, despite the fact she couldn't have a conversation with her mother. The mother listened to her and started to do that. And the daughter then wrote, and I don't know whether she was 9 or 10 then, said, "I chose to be autistic." And her mother on the computer said, "Well, what do you mean you chose?" She said, "When I was in utero, I limited the nutrients that I had. So I would have to go within. So I would have more of an internal experience rather than an external one. So I, through those limits, I have learned how to resource that inner world far better because of those physical limits." Now, this was, I think she was about 9 or 10 when she finally admitted to her mother her understanding of why she was autistic. What do you make of that? I mean, it's like, I found that the more that you explore, the more the mystery deepens.
Yes.
But it also gives you a more of a sense of something that makes sense on some deeper level. Even though you can't work it quite out yet, it means so much more than how we're taught, you know, what we're here for. And all the belief systems are so limited because they're not honoring this inner resonance that's giving us often a lot of information, but we don't listen because we can't quantify it with our left brain, you know, conscious mind is saying, "Well, that can't be possible. Why is it impossible? How do we know what's impossible? We don't know what's impossible because we don't even know what's possible. So how can we possibly dare to say we know what reality is? We haven't a clue."
Yeah, I think you make some really good points there. And one of the things that I see in the way that this journey has taken me is that there's a lot of work to be done just in terms of removing the limitations, falsifying the beliefs that we have, and not falling for the trap of, what does that mean? You know, well, what does that mean? And I often encounter that with people, that it's like the first sign of a shift for them is for them to say, "Well, then what does that mean?" You know, jump to the conclusion. And you have to say, "Well, I don't know what it means." I mean, for example, with the near-death experience, I often go, the idea that consciousness ends at death has been falsified. Clearly the data suggests it's false. So heaven is real. I didn't say that. I don't know that. I just know that consciousness in some way we don't understand survives death, you know? And then, but it does seem to me that the essence of what you're saying is something that really resonates with me. And that's that if you can kind of strip off the stuff that was false, you know, that isn't true, that isn't moving you forward, you probably have enough to get you to the next hill that then you can, you know, get to the next point. And that's all you can really do, because you, all you can do is climb that little hill and then see what's beyond. Oh, there's another hill. I got to go climb that one. But you can't jump ahead three or four. At least I can't. Yeah.
I say it's like you're joining the dots, and the dots encompass the universe, because with me, I talk about my reality as an ice floe that I'm standing on. And as I learn more information about my reality, that ice floe melts and I have to jump on the next ice floe, which works for a while until that melts. And I jump to the next one, and it can continually doing that, because as soon as you learn more, that's an old truth now. So, okay. So now what does this information show me? And, you know, and I just think, you know, it just keeps, it keeps expanding. Some people love that, and I do, because the mystery intrigues me. I want to know. I feel like an old Agatha Christie. Who did it? One where, how, you know? I want to know.
Yeah.
I want to know what's at the end here.
And I absolutely love that analogy, the metaphor of the ice floe and, you know, having to jump off because it won't serve you. I mean, it just won't. It'll only take you so far, and then you have to leave it. So tell me this, Mary. So where is this taking you in your service work? Because I see you as a people helper, someone who's serving and trying to serve other people. Why are you serving the way you are? What have you learned that drives you towards the kind of service that you're doing?
Well, I think that anyone that goes into any form of healing field, I mean, I started out as a nurse and midwife. I realized the limits of that, because all we were doing was fixing rather than looking at preventative medicine, basically. So I went from that into counseling, saying, okay, so if we can fix more of the psychological, you know, issues that create the illness, then that's a step further into helping somebody heal and fix themselves up, if you like. From that, it went into the spiritual realm, because, you know, when you do grief and bereavement, I worked with a lot of people that were dying. When people are facing death, that is profound. They explore all the big issues in life. And it's always been, for me, if it's been weird and wonderful or strange, I've always been fascinated. Like, I've wanted to understand why we're here. What's it all about? Even as a child, it fascinated me. If it was strange, weird, and wonderful. And I had a mother that encouraged that, because she was always fascinated in that as well. So it's been a desire to understand, why am I here? What's it all about? So I go through the counseling, and then I get to people that explain that normal everyday people that have lost someone very precious to them, and then they will be aware of their fragrance, or they will be aware that they're close to them. So I get a real sense that that when we die, there is still life. There is life, because people are getting these, apart from mediums and clairvoyance, fascinating experiences that show there's a tangibility to life after death. Okay, so how else can I, not from my Catholicism, they don't even believe in reincarnation. So I go into looking at it in more depth, and I find that when I work with past lives, that people go to other planets and what have you. But it was when someone came to me and said, Mary, I've heard you're open-minded. There are no support groups for this. Nobody wants to listen because they think you're crazy. Well, that's the first thing that intrigues Mary, you see, if it's unusual, and tells me about his experiences. He marks on his body, shaved areas on his leg. His family are having experiences. The relatives won't come to the house because they think it's demons. What can I do? And it was really then, and I laugh with Ellis, who's become a really good friend of mine since. I said, oh, you're for Ellis. I'm down this weird path. He's a beautiful bloke. And anyway, but the whole thing intrigued me, is that it made a lot of sense on many levels. And the main thing was too, nobody seemed to know where to go. And I thought, well, there's plenty of people for grief and bereavement. There's plenty of people for this, and there's plenty of people doing all these other things. So, Mary, where are you in this? And I just thought, I've got to find out. I've got to understand. And if there are experiences in this reality that is still not explored or understood, or if I can help those in this particular way, however, and I didn't even know how I was going to do it, Alex, to be honest, other than listen openly. That was my first protocol. And then say, okay, what can I do that will help you understand that? How can we look at that from different perspectives? Or what information will be useful? All those kinds of things in the same way I would approach anything. I'm actually a very practical kind of person. What's going to be useful to you? How's this going to, you know, the usual things. And I found that what I thought was a really special, unique experience actually wasn't. Mm-hmm. That more and more people found me in the most bizarre ways. And I thought, well, this is telling me that this is important. And of course, when you realize what this actually means in terms of us as a species, it's the big stuff. You can't, I tell you, the big stuff always, you know, let somebody else do that one. This is the big stuff. You know, I want to be part of that big stuff because it's interesting, you know. Right. And what can you do? You're on that track and you've got to find out more and more information. And more than anything, it's been my journey too, because through helping others, even though I have no conscious experiences that I can put into that box, doesn't matter. If enough people have been to Alaska and told me Alaska exists, you know, end of, you know, and it's one of my favorite quotes on the, you know, television when they say, do you believe them? Well, I may never go to Alaska, but if enough people go and tell me what it's like and take pictures, then I've got to believe it exists. End of, you know, that's the end of it. And when you've got people, the amazing panorama, children, particularly children, the detail when children tell you what the skin of the beings feels like, dolphin skin. What child knows that? What child talks about going through walls and learning things on the craft at 5 years old? And mummy, you're not my real mummy. My mummy's in space. You're just here to look after me. And no, I can't draw myself because you'd be frightened. What 5-year-old says things like that? You know, the children don't see talk shows. They don't read books on this. They only know their experience. And this is what the children are saying. You know, that for me is, you can't get more tangible than that when children are explaining things they should have no knowledge of. And, you know, they're 5 or 6. And when a child of 10 tells me that they came through a portal in the sun, that's where they come from. Now, what child knows about portals, you know, or whatever? I mean, it's another little boy looking at this picture here and telling me that is actually a gate into other universes. And there are some universes that are artificial, that in fact, they have geometric planets, if you like, that are created by some of the beings. And, you know, he said, and sometimes technology is sent through those portals. He described in that picture, the actual planet is a lot bigger that he passes when he's in a craft. It's actually bigger than that, Mary. And it's actually, this is the pathway I go through into those other universes. And the beings seed other planets. This is an 8-year-old telling me this. Mm-hmm. And he also drew a being on this drawing. And I said, where did you see this being? And he said, oh, it doesn't exist anymore. And I said, why? He said, because of the Big Bang. It got too close to the Big Bang. So I said, so you are saying that there was life before the Big Bang? He said, yes. He said, and this was before our Big Bang. And then you hear Alan Kuhn, who's a physicist, talking about the expanding universe and that we have constant Big Bangs. And you say, okay. So what the children are saying actually has a possible credibility, even though as yet I don't know enough to say, to qualify that absolutely. Isn't it fascinating that a child talks about a being extinct, getting close to our Big Bang? What 8-year-old knows things like that? You know, and that's the thing, Alex, you know, it's this kind of information that gives it an enormous amount of credibility and tangibility.
Yeah.
Even though at the moment, we can't qualify it.
So where do you think this research needs to go? Where would you like to see it go from a very practical basis in terms of laying out some kind of plan? What would you like to see happen in terms of highest priorities? Or are you not as attached to, you know, there's this other side of this. There's this other side of this kind of spiritual knowledge, spiritual science that says, you know, we don't have to do too much. You know, everything is going to work out the way it's going to work out. And we don't have to be these little busy bees over here, because that's kind of a thing. Yeah. But I think I know from just talking to you a couple times that we have to push that edge too. You know, we just have to challenge that a little bit and not be too busy, but not be too complacent either. Where does this need to go? What are your priorities in terms of what needs to happen for this research to move forward?
Well, one of the things I haven't mentioned to you is that I've connected with a group. They're based in Miami. So we're going to have the story with as many witnesses. I mean, one of them is going to be Giles, who's my science advisor, who's a geneticist, who lives 5 minutes away from here, who was one of my clients, who was dealing with his science side that says, I can't be seeing UFOs, I can't be seeing beings in my room, but my partner's been seeing them as well as me. My father sees the UFOs, thought he was going crazy, came to see me 2 years ago. And really, since then, he's been to the US, had some incredible experiences when he went to James Gilliland's ranch and others, has come back and now bought a 40-acre block just down the road from me. He's going to tell his story, because there he is. He was assistant senior scientist at the CSIRO in Tasmania. We've got Ray, who's got all his credentials as an attorney. We'll have another really brilliant story. And then we'll get Rudy and Edgar and others from Edgar's own scientific colleagues to help to balance out the experience by, as much as possible, bringing the latest science understanding of quantum physics to say, well, actually, this isn't so hard if you look at it from this perspective, so that we can present very credible information that we've covered as many bases, so that we're, you know, because that's been part of the problem, Alex, is that documentary makers look for the sensationalist. They look at what they can do to make the person out to be as a crazy space cadet as possible 9 times out of 10. They bring in skeptics that haven't a clue about this phenomena and think that they have the right to even say anything when they've not even read half a page of anything to do with this. So what we're saying is, nah, we are going to control the data that goes to the public, and it's going to come from the basis of decent research through people that are coming from a place of at least openness in terms of the matrix, as well as scientists. Like Rudy was, I spent 4 days in Newport, and Rudy was looking at all these amazing drawings my clients had done, looking at them from a quantum perspective or from an astrophysicist point of view. And it was amazing. I never thought I would spend, of all people, you know, people like Dennis Briefer, an engineer, they were more interested in this weird stuff, the scripts that my clients do, the geometric forms that seem to take people into another space, if you like. They act as a kind of conduit, a portal, and others where they come out with these star languages. What are they? Some of them look very similar to old Sumerian, some of the old Arabic, and many others, but they say they're from their star families, and they can speak them as naturally as you and I speak English. What is all of that? You know, how can you not look at that and say, why are they doing this? You know, they're doing all this strange stuff after their experiences. Why can't you see that as a evidence of an experience? You don't do that normally, right. You know?
Right.
You know what I mean? It's all the expressions that and changes and the way they understand healing from a completely different perspective in how they are able to work with energies, see auras, One lady told me that she can go forward in time if she wants an answer about her future self. She can project her consciousness to forward in time to what her future self can advise her and bring that information back into her present self. I mean, that is just brilliant, you know? Why can we not listen to this stuff?
You know, one thing that Jacob said that I did think was pretty spot on is he said, okay, so none of it's, you know, otherworldly, alien, none of it's any of that. Okay. Just explain it in conventional terms for me. Kind of along the lines what you're saying. You know, there's a term for that, I forget. What, you know, when people have the spontaneous ability to speak other languages. Great. Just approach it from that standpoint. Just tell me how it works from that standpoint. We can leave the aliens out of it. Just tell me how it works there. Yeah. Or tell me how this works. Tell me how this works. It's like, well, you know, I don't know.
Why aren't we exploring this? Why aren't we looking at why a 9-year-old from Northern Europe over Skype, via an interpreter coming out with the languages in front of me, literally just articulating the language. And she said one of them actually heals water. In other words, the frequency, she said, heals water. And she, you know, what 9-year-old talks like? And I said, can you articulate it for me? Right in front of me, over Skype, this 9-year-old doesn't even speak English, is saying this language to me, this stranger. I had a 7-year-old get my book, which has got alien script in it, from the Sunshine Coast here. Her mother said she told me, Mary, that she could read it. So I said to the 7-year-old, I said, could you read this script to me? It was one Tracy Taylor did. And she said, do you want it in the language or do you want it in English? So I said, well, could you do it in the language first and then tell me what it is in English? Yes, she said. So she repeats it in the language. Then she tells me what it says. And she said, and I think this comes from the Greys. She's 7.
So, Mary, I mean, one thought I have. I mean, the free thing is awesome and the documentaries are great. What about just publishing more stuff, more regressions? Is there a problem with that? I know there's a privacy issue, but beyond that, I'd like to see more of that. I think there's a lot of people that like to see more of that. I think it's powerful. I think there's something about the rawness of it that in some ways works better than documentaries or, you know, packaged stuff. And I think it's also, it resonates with people from a current, you know, social media kind of standpoint. Any thoughts on, I saw the one that you did with the guy.
Peter.
Peter, it's compelling stuff, you know, it's compelling stuff.
And it happens more than you know, where there is another intelligence that will come in and answer questions.
But the other thing that it kind of reveals is that if you take this thing and if you approach it kind of like I am, with a kind of semi-skeptical kind of prove it to me, make this fit with the other things that I know. Like one thing it does, it's hard for anyone to really challenge your protocol, you know? Although I would have liked to seen the whole thing. I would have liked to seen the induction, the exact thing that you go through, because I think what it would have shown is, come on, you know, she didn't do any kind of Vulcan mind trick, anything like that.
It's exactly the same as my CDs. You know, I've got a whole range of meditation CDs. I use color and imagery. That's all, to take people to the place where they finally, and there's a shift that goes from where they're saying, well, I see a doorway out of this room into where we're going. Then they sort of shift and you're saying to the subconscious, now we're looking at the origin of this experience, and they will go to whatever age is appropriate. Even though they, you know, they may not remember, their subconscious will know. And I often use doorways. I'll say, well, this is starting from the age you are now, going back in time. Which doorway do you need to stand in front of? And what age does it say? And they will say, oh, it's 7 or it's 5. I will never know where they will go. And then when you take them through it, then that's when you start to get them to describe whatever it is that is presenting to them. And I am, you know, it really is, there's a kind of shift that goes on from where, you know, you're getting them to say, oh, well, what does the door look like? I'm getting them to use their visual self, you know, the inner eye to do that. And they may say, oh, well, I think it's, you know, it looks like wood. And I'm saying, fine. So that I know that I'm getting them to be able to use their inner eye for their information. And once I've got that, then I let them literally most of the time I'll say, what happens next? I won't give them any clues. They'll say, oh, I'm seeing this. What happens next? There is no input. There is nothing. Oh, so what happens next? And sometimes I'll say, look around. They'll say, I'm not aware of anything. Well, just have a look around. And is it the same? So sometimes because they're actually not wanting to say there's a being standing there because they don't want to admit it. So I'll say, are you alone? Or I'm not sure. Right. Well, have another look around. Have a sense. And they'll say, oh, there's one right here. Or there's another one right here. OK, so what do they look? Oh, I don't know. Right. Well, just I want you to turn around and look really slowly. And gradually they'll be able to build up what they're actually seeing, because there's a lot of fear often in the way. So you've got to just take them that step beyond, you know, where they want to go sometimes. But if it's completely closed down, then they won't tell you anyway. You know, they'll just say, I don't see anything. And then, you know, OK, the psyche's saying, nah, don't want to go there. And I don't push that, Alex, because I always believe that the psyche knows best. So if the psyche's saying they're not ready, some will get feeling really sick or something like that. And it's another part of them saying they're not ready yet. So I listen to all those cues that the psyche is saying to say, not time yet, they're not ready yet, or whatever, however that manifests. Because, you know, it is about their process. It's not what I want to know. It's what they want to know when they're ready to hear it. So it's working with them and what is okay for them. It's not, you know, this isn't my journey, this is theirs. So the focus is always on them. And that's, to me, is you know, the only ethical way to work, because you're working with someone's psyche, and what they may see and experience may be really huge. And it takes time to come to terms with the fact that, you know, they may see themselves being told that one of the beings is their genetic father. How would you like to be told this blue being standing in front of you, 6 foot tall, with no hair and big black eyes, is a genetic part of you? That takes some dealing with, you know. So, I'm testing the water the whole time. I'm in there with them. I'm in there every step of the way, because I sort of tune in too, if you know what I mean. And that's really important, because when you use with hypnosis, your voice has to be the frequency to get them into the frequency. So my voice is of that frequency, which helps them to actually resonate with that. So, and I do get kind of an intuition way to go sometimes, and I follow that as well. So it's like, okay, we need to go that way. Okay. So all the time I'm working on a multi-level. They're trusting me with something really unique and special. And I can't abuse that. So I have to be, and this is why I get very upset with inept amateur people who learn a bit of hypnosis and think they can do this, because this isn't right. You've got to understand screen memories. You've got to understand if they're seeing a clown, what to ask. So they're not seeing the clown and they're actually seeing who it is. You know, there are all those things. If you don't know about screens, if you don't know about how they can sometimes present themselves, then you're actually saying, oh, so you're seeing a clown. Okay, we're in the wrong room. You know, so all that, you have to know the phenomena. You have to know what to ask. And many experiences say that UFO researchers don't always know what to ask. They don't ask the right questions. And that I took to heart. So before we start, I'll say to my client, what is it you most want to know? What are the priorities for you in terms of our focus? Because that's where we'll go. And I do always the conscious memory first with talking with them. And then I'll say, right, now we've talked to the other part of you. We know now that to ask that other part of you to give us what it is that is most useful for you right at this moment in time. Not more than you need, just enough. So we're putting out that intent. And I believe that that is really important, that your intent has that motivation and that integrity. And with that, then the person can feel safe enough to know that another part of them is guiding that, because it is their subconscious, superconscious, higher self, whatever name you want to give to it. If they're very spiritual, I'll use spiritual terms. If they're very cognitive, are you subconscious, superconscious, or even just the part of you that knows, that deeper part? So I'm working from a spiritual base, not just purely a clinical one, because this is a spiritual journey. Mm-hmm. They're learning to change and understand who they are and why they're here and what it's about and why they have a sense of mission, why they have a sense of purpose, why they are motivated in the way that they're motivated. Those are all the questions. Mm-hmm. So we're asking the higher part of them for those answers from however they can understand them in the most balanced and healthy way for them to integrate them. So that's the intent. So that's what we're putting out. And that's how it sort of unfolds. Mm-hmm. Whatever's right for them then unfolds from that baseline. You know, I trust that absolutely. And it's always worked. Otherwise, I'd probably be sued by a lot of people, wouldn't I?
Yeah.
So there is, you know, that's the difference, Alex, is that I'm coming very much from a spiritual perspective. And, you know, through my own sort of sense of integrity and professionalism, which is really important, you know, and always has been for me, you know.
Well, that's awesome. It's absolutely great work. I'm going to try and put this together the best way I can and get it out there. People need to hear this. I mean, I think obviously, you know, there's a lot of people out there that desperately need your help more than they need more Marys. You know, there's not going to be enough, and you're going to have more emails. But I don't know what we do about that either, though. You know, I mean, because as you just alluded to, I mean, that's tough too. You know, on one hand, we need to train other therapists in doing this. Have you thought about that? Has that?
I have. And I do have therapists that come to me and say, can you teach me how you work? And so I say, well, you're going to have to open up the other side of you, that intuitive side as well, because you'll need this, because those that come to me are highly intuitive, as well as, you know, they can be highly intelligent, but also are highly intuitive. I said, and so they're going to sense whether you're going to be the right person for them or not, and whether you're open enough, because they'll only tell you as much as they feel safe to tell you. So that's the first thing. So it's about being really open, and open to what you don't know is really important as well. That even if it might confront you, doesn't mean because it's confronting you that it's not actually has a tangibility. It's just that you haven't come across it before. So that's really, really important that they honor. I mean, a CERN honors all realities, because that's all I can do. Because ultimately, we don't know what reality consists of. So it's a bit arrogant to say, well, only that bit of reality I'm going to take and that bit I'm not, you know. So that's the thing. I have looked at training, and I think I've got a feeling down the track that may be very much part of my mandate, is to work with people, because I'm very good at working with people intuitively. I've learned a lot of skills in terms of what would they call the intuitive side of things, how to tune in, how to be open to information coming in from not the non-quantifiable, but often very accurate part of our inner knowing. So I work with that. I can teach people how to do it and have confidence in it as well. So that's another thing people don't always know, but I do.
Okay, well, terrific. And thanks again so much. And I'll be in touch. We'll just stay in touch. I'd love to stay in touch.
Absolutely. And I'll send you the article that has just been published in Nexus, because it was on my presentation for Nexus. And it's all about the ADD, ADHD, and also about the new kids. So it really is hot off the press.
Great. I'll include that in. Okay.
Okay.
Thanks again, Mary. Take care.
All right, Alex. Take care. Bye for now.
Thanks again to Mary Rodwell for joining me today on Skeptico. There are a number of questions I might want to tee up from this interview, but I'll pick just one, and a rather tame one at that. What are the best criteria that we should use in evaluating what kind of human experiences are worth investigating, worth exploring? If you remember all the way back to the intro to this episode, one of Mary's points is, there's all these people who are reporting a similar experience. It's the same across culture. It's the same across profession, education level. Isn't that curious? Shouldn't we investigate that more? Or as David Jacobs says, hey, forget about the alien component. Just look at it from the standpoint of all these people reporting the same thing. Isn't that a psychological phenomena that we want to investigate?
So I guess this is kind of a lob question, but let's dig into it anyway. What are the criteria by which we should judge what human experiences deserve our attention, deserve to be elevated to this level of, gee, we got to get to the bottom of that. We can't just sweep it under the rug. Okay, so if you have some thoughts on that, you'd like to connect with me or others about that topic, the place to do it is through the Skeptico website at skeptiko, don't forget the K-O on the end, .com. And from there, you can jump on over to our forum, click on the Facebook link. I'm working on Facebook. I've never really spent much time with it, although I've had a Facebook page, but I'm trying to pull that together as well. So please do come over on Facebook and like me and make a post or connect with me on that way. If you do Facebook, I'd love to see you over there. Or you can do it the old-fashioned way and just drop me an email. Don't get to all the emails, but I try to as best I can. Sooner or later, if you want to, you will connect with me. I try and be pretty available. Of course, while you're at the website, you can also download any of our over 200 previous episodes of Skeptico, subscribe on iTunes, or join the RSS feed. Well, that's going to do it for today on Skeptico. I have a number of interesting interviews. They just keep piling up. Some really fascinating ones. I had one just yesterday that just blew my mind in some kind of more down-to-earth, just kind of strange ways. It's an interview with a very prominent academic who's also very married to the materialistic kind of view of things. It's really an interesting interview. I can't wait to share that with you, but it's going to take a few weeks because I have a number of other interesting shows in the hopper, and I'm going to get all those out just as soon as I can. It is the holidays right now here for me, so I don't know if I can get them out quite as quick as I'd like to, but I'll do my best. So do stay with me for all of that, and until next time, take care, and bye for now.